How's everybody doing? Oh, come on. Let's try that one more time. How's everybody doing? I know it's 4 o'clock. I appreciate you being here. I know everyone's kind of got the after lunch, not quite to dinner yet. Don't know if I got the second cup of coffee yet. Need beer. Well, those are your words, not mine. It's a pleasure to be here. My name is Jeff Woolsey. I'm a principal program manager in the Windows Server and Cloud Division. I'm going to go ahead and get started. I basically could talk to you guys for 4 days in a row, but they only gave me 75 minutes. So we're going to cram it all in as much as we can. I'm going to focus on Hyper-V storage and networking in Windows Server 2012, but there's actually a number of other areas I'm going to delve into a little bit too, such as scale-up and some of the changes we've had to make to Hyper-V and virtualization. So it really is a pleasure to be here. We've had a lot of great stuff. If you saw the keynote yesterday, I did a couple demos in Brad Anderson's keynote, and we got a bunch of things to add to that. But some of the session objectives and takeaways: number one, why Server 2012 for private cloud? More specifically, what did we learn from you, our customers and our partners? And let me be very clear, this was release dictated by you. Okay? We've got a nice big laundry list of features that we continue to go through. But the important thing is we always prioritize the things that are most important to you first. So we're going to talk about scale-up workloads, talk about storage, networking. And again, I want to be very clear, there's no way we can cover everything in one session. Just no way. And it's a nice problem to have. It just means that this is a feature-rich release. And I encourage you to take a look at the Windows Server blogs and more of the content that's coming out over time here. So some cloud considerations. Few things. When we talked with you guys, you basically said, you know, we do want to virtualize more of our scale-up workloads. Okay? We want to go after those really big workloads. Those things that require dozens of cores, hundreds of gigabytes of memory, SAN attached. And there's a lot of things that go along with that. Storage. Whether you're using SAN, whether you're using file, whether you're using block, we want to give you the best solution for all of your storage needs. I'm going to let you in on a little secret. How many of you own a SAN? Anybody? Pretty much 75% of you. Here's a little secret. If you own a SAN, Windows Server 2012 is a no-brainer. It's really that simple. If you own a SAN, Server 2012 is a no-brainer, and I'll explain that in a minute. Continuous availability. We've looked at the entire stack, storage, networking, even beyond that, VM replication cross-site. We wanted to provide a continuous availability across the stack. VM mobility. This is something you guys have had a lot of input in. I'll explain what this means when I get to a lot of your input around live migration. Networking. Huge challenges here. Boy, it's very clear that we hit a hot button yesterday. When I demonstrated network virtualization, I could look out in the audience and I saw eyes like this everywhere. When we were done, people came by the booth all day yesterday going, number one, I was already sold on Hyper-V and Server 2012. Already there. Now you showed me network virtualization, and I'm like over the moon. You need to explain this even further. So it's clear that we hit a hot button. Everybody seems to be running into the same problem. VLANs, that was a nice solution 15, 20 years ago. It was a nice solution for your static workloads. When you've got workloads flying all over the place, or when you're trying to deliver solutions at cloud scale, VLANs fall apart. They weren't designed for this. So let's talk about scale-up workloads. First of all, scale isn't just more virtual processors. I get this all the time. With Server 2008 R2, hey Jeff, I need more than 4 virtual processors so I can run my big scale-up workloads. Well, yes and no. Forget about virtual machines for a second. I can give you a physical server with 1,000 cores in it. If it only has a gig of memory, who cares? You're never going to keep the CPUs busy. Okay, so we drop in a terabyte of memory, but it still only has a single NIC, or still only has a single disk. It's a game I like to play called Where's the Bottleneck? In fact, almost all of the issues we see, for example, around SQL, have nothing to do with Hyper-V. It's about the storage behind it. Get this thing happened all the time. Jeff, I was running SQL on physical machines, everything ran great, and then I moved it to Hyper-V, and the performance isn't good. Tell me why. I'm like, well, forget about Hyper-V for a second. Tell me about the storage. Well, over here I had 100 spindles, but over here I have 2 spindles. What? I'm not kidding, folks. And I ask him, why on earth do you think that that's going to be the same? Well, it's virtual, right? It's virtual. It's not magic, folks. Okay? So it is about balance. It's a really important point to make. We want to maximize hardware usage, and your VM performance must increase with cores. That last one sounds really silly. Even for me to say it sounds silly. But it's an important point here. Because guess what? If you don't do your homework, I could have actually given you more cores, and your performance could have gone down. Okay? With Server 2008 R2, we have four virtual processors, and people have asked, you know, couldn't we just give you 8 or 10 or 12 or give you some more in 2008 R2? We could have, but if we didn't do the work in the guest in terms of NUMA, your performance could actually be inconsistent, which is worse than going down. Try and troubleshoot that. Or it could actually degrade over time. We don't want that. Virtualization benefits like live migration should just work. This one, again, sounds really simple, but let me explain this. We spent a lot of time on pre-planning for Server 2012. In fact, I saw Bill Lang, one of our vice president for server, I saw a note that said we spent over $10 million just in pre-planning. No code, no testing, just going out and talking with you about what was important. And in the case of live migration, we would ask customers, look, I can give you shiny new feature X, but if I give you shiny new feature X, this VM can't be live migrated anymore. It's locked to this machine. How do you feel about shiny new feature X? And the answer was always, I never want to see shiny new feature X again. I have to be able to live migrate VMs around for planned downtime, for unplanned downtime. In fact, I want you to go the opposite way. I want you to make it easier for me to move VMs anywhere. Okay, that's a tough one, but we heard you loud and clear. We also want to virtualize those workloads considered non-virtualizable. And what I mean by that is, a lot of folks have virtualized their file, their print, their web, their SQL. They're doing it today very successfully with Hyper-V. But they got that big workload sitting on the corner on the bare metal. And I'm talking about that big monster SQL. Okay, it's using 24, 32 cores. It's got 250, 384, 512 gigs of memory, and it's attached to my SAN. And I've left that on the bare metal. Those are the workloads we targeted with Hyper-V and Windows Server 2012. I can already do your web. I can already do your print. Let me let you on a little secret. Microsoft.com, as of this month, has been powered by Hyper-V for over 4 years. TechNet, msdn.microsoft.com, I'm sure you went there to download the beta for Windows 8 client, Windows 8 server. That's all been powered by Hyper-V for 4 years. No downtime. So when anybody asks me, gosh, I don't know, can Hyper-V deliver performance and scale? I'm like, we've been doing it for years. Let me be very clear. If there was downtime, there's this shy, retiring gentleman at Microsoft you may have heard of. His name is Steve Ballmer. If his site went down, he'd probably be standing on my desk. So I'm very confident we can deliver the performance and scale you need. And now we're going to ratchet up big time with Windows Server 2012. In addition, server resiliency, uptime, and security is paramount because more resources and capacity are ever before on the server. You've got more cores, you've got more memory than ever before. We want to look at the entire stack. From a NUMA standpoint, let's talk about physical NUMA for a second. To scale up, okay, on a physical machine, you have to deal with challenges of NUMA. And NUMA essentially is about dealing with some issues that we had in the past. Long, long ago, we used to have servers with single processors. Then we added two processors and three processors and four processors. And they were all accessing I/O and they were all sharing the same bus. And they were all communicating with memory over the same bus. And we realized that doesn't scale over a specific amount of cores. In fact, the bus couldn't keep up. So we did come up with NUMA. NUMA stands for non-uniform memory access. And essentially what this does is you group processors and you group memory into what we call nodes. So each node has a processor and memory, and it gives you what we call local resources and remote resources. And local resources mean the memory is in the same node as the processor. And if the processor needs to access memory outside the node, it can, but it's remote, it may have to make a NUMA hop. So it helps hosts scale up, and partition cores, again, are mapped into nodes, and allocation and latency depends on location. So for example, NUMA-aware applications are more and more common every day, because SQL, Exchange, your database, even IIS in Windows Server 2012 is NUMAware. And the important thing to understand is when an application allocates threads and memory resources, you want to do it all in the same NUMA node. You want to keep it in the same NUMA node, and you want to avoid traversing NUMA nodes as much as possible. That gives you the best possible performance. And high-performance applications will detect this and minimize crossing the NUMA nodes. So that's the physical side. So here, for example, is what good NUMA looks like. Here's a four-socket machine. It's got four NUMA nodes. This is optimal. The system is balanced. And what I mean by that is memory and allocations, thread allocations, they're happening within the same NUMA node, and memory is populated in each NUMA node. So you can see it's a very balanced system. Again, I keep coming back to that word, balance. Well, let me show you what a non-optimal NUMA system looks like. Okay, this is far from optimal. Number one, the system is imbalanced. Memory and allocation and thread allocations are happening across different NUMA nodes. Number two, NUMA node 2 has an odd number of DIMMs. So if, for example, I want to do some sort of interleaving, there's a very good chance that's not happening. NUMA nodes 2 and 3 don't have enough local memory. And worst case, node number 4 has no local memory at all. So everything is remote. So again, this is a good example of good versus bad. So in the virtual world, we want to give you massive scale-up VMs. To do that, we need to provide NUMA in the virtual machine itself. So we're introducing virtual NUMA. What this does is we actually, for the first time, present NUMA topology within the virtual machine. What we do is when we create the virtual machine, we look at the underlying physical topology. And what we do is we map we create a virtual machine that maps as closely to the physical topology as possible so that your applications and OS running in the VM knows that information, and thread allocations and memory allocations are done with best physical locality. This is how you get exceptional linear scalability within a virtual machine. And again, virtual NUMA nodes are aligned with host resources. I should also point out this is done in an industry standard way using the SRAT tables. So for example, I've had a number of people ask, does this 32 virtual processors, is this only for Windows? No, Linux gets this as well. Be very clear about that. It's policy driven per host. We can do a best effort or we can force alignment. The key thing to understand about virtual NUMA is this. When you create the VM, we do all the work for you. We automatically look at everything on the physical topology, and we do all of the work for you. If you think you're smarter than us, and you do want to go and tweak all the knobs, we've included the knobs as well. But in general, I'm going to tell you, leave it as is. In addition, we've also included a nice big reset button in case you start changing the NUMA settings and you realize, ooh, how do I get back to a known good state? Just click on the big reset, use hardware topology button, and things will magically be aligned again for you. So we've thought about that. In terms of scale, just to give you an idea of where we've come over the last few releases, if you look between Server 2008 R2 and Server 2012 beta, this is a huge jump in scale. And again, these are numbers based on the beta today. We've gone from 64 to 160 logical processors. And to put that in perspective, what is 160 logical processors? That means the physical server has 8 sockets, each socket has 10 cores, and then you've enabled symmetric multithreading. That's a very big box, costs roughly about $75,000. So we can support really big machines. 2 terabytes of physical memory, 64 nodes, and up to 4,000 virtual machines in a cluster, the largest clusters in the industry, up to 32 virtual processors, up to 1 terabyte of memory per virtual machine. In terms of live migration, no limits. The limit is only how much hardware you want to provide us. If you've got a gigabit live migration network, maybe we can do maybe 2, maybe we can do 4. If you've got 10 gigabit, maybe we can do 10, maybe we can do 12, depending on how busy they are. If you've got teamed 10 gigabit, maybe we can do 20 at a time. Well, next year when you upgrade to 40 gigabit, maybe we can do 30 or 40 of these simultaneously. And in a couple of years down the road when you upgrade to teamed 40 or teamed 100, guess what? Maybe we'll do hundreds of these simultaneously. The limit is your hardware, okay? Live migration is ready to rock and roll right now. In terms of storage migration, we've also have that capability. Again, with no limits, as much as your hardware will allow. 64 servers in a cluster, and finally, one other little tidbit, the VP to LP ratio. This is a number I've hated for the longest time. It really makes no sense at all. Basically, it's the number of virtual processors per logical processor, where a logical processor equals a thread or a core in the system. Basically, we've said, that's it, there's no limit. It's how much horsepower you want to provide. If you've got a server that's 4 years old, maybe it's 8-to-1, maybe it's 10-to-1. If you've got a hard server that was built and you just bought it and just arrived yesterday, maybe it's 25-to-1, maybe it's 30-to-1. Next year when you buy that brand new server, maybe it's 35, 41, I don't know. You tell me. It's how much hardware you want to bring to the party. Here's 32 virtual processors, and I specifically did this one on Windows Server 2008 R2. If you were at the keynote yesterday, I did the demo on Windows Server 2012. But I wanted to show you this on Server 2008 R2, so you can see this is on down-level clients as well. And I'm glad you're all sitting, because there is CentOS Linux. That's 32 virtual processors in CentOS Linux as well. So we're quite serious about scale. When it comes to storage, I mentioned this already before, and I'm going to mention this again. If you own a SAN, Server 2012 is a no-brainer. We have done a tremendous amount of work on both block-level storage and file-level storage. What do I mean by that? Number one, virtual fiber channel. How many of you have fiber channel in your infrastructure? Anybody? Yep, looks like all the SAN guys raising their hand again. Good to see you. With virtual fiber channel, we are presenting real, honest-to-goodness fiber channel in the VM. I've had a number of people come by and ask me about this going, really? This is real fiber channel? You're not filtering or doing anything? No. This is real, unadulterated fiber channel, which means if you want to run guest clustering, you want to run MPIO, you want to run DSM software like EMC PowerPath, works flawlessly in a Hyper-V VM. Support for file-based storage. This is new. So again, we've done a tremendous amount of work on the file side as well. We now support low-cost file-based storage based on SMB 2.2. Because we understand that people have said, we want to also, at the same time, there may be cases where file is plenty for what I need. So we now support file-based storage. We have the new VHDX format. It's more resilient. Also, hugely, massively scalable. Support for up to 64 terabytes per virtual disk. Or, as I like to say it, 32 times anyone else in the industry. That's just included in the box. Online meta operations. That's a fancy way of saying we now do hot, live everything when it comes to storage. You want to live merge snapshots? You got it. You want to actually point to a new parent disk live without any downtime? You can do that as well. All sorts of cool new storage things that we're enabling under the hood. Native 4K disk support. This one I wanted to mention briefly because I'm not sure where a lot of folks are aware of this, but this is an important thing to understand that's coming in the industry. Today, when you buy a disk, and you see these disks are getting huge, 3 terabyte disks, $99. You notice a lot of them will say they're 512E disks. Historically, we've had 512 sector size disks. That's what's been shipping. But a while ago, the storage vendor said, look, we want to get to these massive, massive, massive capacity drives. We got to switch the sector size to a 4K size. Okay? In the interim, we're going to provide these 512E disks. They present themselves as 512 to the operating system. On the back end, they're actually 4K aligned. In the future, they're going to ship native 4K disks. Why am I telling you this? This is a very important point here. None of your operating systems today work with 4K disks. Think about that for a second. You put in your Windows Server 2008 R2, your Server 2003, your Linux, your VMware ESX. It doesn't know what a 4K disk is. Server 2012 knows all about 4K disks. So as you start to adopt 4K disks, because you want to get that new large capacity drives, and you try and convert and you try and run those older servers with the new drives, it won't work. You run setup on the OS. The OS says, I don't even see the disk. A great way to solve that problem is to run Windows Server 2012, put that on the native metal, take all of your older operating systems, virtualize them on Hyper-V, and you can take advantage of 4K disk support. It's a very important thing because it's coming in the industry. And when your OS is no longer work, you're going to say, what just happened here? Well, it's 4K disks. It's okay. We know it's coming. We're all ready. Server's ready to take care of you. Offloaded data transfer, ODX. I'll get to that in one sec. Let's talk about Fibre Channel for one second here. Had a lot of people ask me about this. So number one, I've been asked, is there anything special I should know about zoning and masking? Worldwide node names, port, anything I need to do special? No, in fact, that was a design goal. It's important to understand, anybody here zone and mask SANs, storage, LUNs? It's kind of a religion. There are guys that know how to do this in their sleep, and there's a way you do it. The last thing we wanted to do is say, by the way, zone and mask your physical machines one way and your virtual machines another way. No. And I'll show you that in the UI in a second. But you assign fiber channel adapters to VMs, you give them worldwide node names and port names, and guess what? They can access your storage area network just like your physical resources. It works with live migration. That's a big one. And I'm going to go back to a point I kind of touched on earlier, live migration itself. Every new feature in Hyper-V works with live migration. This is an important point. So as I give you things like fiber channel, there's no compromises. So if you want to virtualize that massive SQL server, that massive insert line of business application server here that needs access to the fiber channel, you're not giving up live migration. Works just flawlessly. ODX. So this is one of the reasons why Windows Server 2012 is a no-brainer for SAN owners. Let me explain ODX. Today, with Server 2008 R2, suppose I need to copy 10 terabytes of storage from one part of the array to another part of the array. With Server 2008 R2, I'm going to go read and write. Read and write. It'll work. It'll be correct. But there's going to be a lot of I.O. Server's going to handle all that I.O., and it's going to make it happen. And 10 terabytes could take quite a while. In Server 2012, Server will call to the array and say, array, do you support offloaded data transfer? The array comes back and says, why, yes, I do. Great. Here's a secure token. Please copy that 10 terabytes for me. Number one, there's no I.O. between the server and the array. The array does all the work. Number two, for the array, it actually may not need to copy the 10 terabytes. It literally may be moving pointers. So something that could have taken you hours or days could be done in seconds. That's a huge, huge win. We've been working with all the storage vendors, you name it. They are excited out of their mind on this one. The nice thing is, this is just transparent. If this is a file copy, like literally, we take care of it for you. There's no ODX button you need to go find. There's nothing you need to enable. We just talk to the SAN, either the SAN supports it or the SAN doesn't. If the SAN doesn't support it, then we'll just copy it the way we've always copied it. For a Hyper-V standpoint, we take full advantage of it as well. For example, creating a fixed disk. One of the things I asked the guys over in storage, I said, today to create a 10 gigabyte fixed disk, it's a single file, and it's 10 gigabytes in size, and to do it on a standard tower desktop machine takes about 3 minutes. It's a single file, and we zero it for security. I said, how long does this take on an ODX machine? Well, it takes about 3 minutes on a standard desktop. They said, watch this. They said, by the way, Jeff, don't blink. Click done. So something that took 3 minutes is done in less than half a second. Dynamic disks, where we're actually growing because the disk needs to expand, will take advantage of ODX as well. VHD merges will take advantage of it. And live storage migration. So if I need to move my VM storage from one part to the next, it will also take advantage of it transparently. So huge wins, all included in the box. So again, it's a no-brainer, folks. Hyper-V storage, no limits in dynamic. Live storage migration, as much as you'd like. VMs on file storage, yes, with SMB 2.2. I also want to point out, I had a couple people come by the booths yesterday and say, hold it, Jeff. Does SMB 2.2 mean only the Windows file server? No. Let me be very clear. We went to NetApp. We went to all of the guys that are out there making file servers. In fact, we even went to, I'm glad you're sitting, the Samba organization. And we told them, guys, this is how you implement SMB 2.2. They wrote a nice blog on it. They were excited out of their mind. They couldn't believe it. They're like, I'm sorry, you're from Microsoft? Yes. Yes, we are. We're here to help. Okay? You know that line, don't you? SMB 2.2. So we're working with all the storage vendors. Honestly, I'll be shocked. I was shocked to find out just how many vendors were still shipping SMB 1.x implementations. So I've always wondered why people always, you know, say, oh, SMB's slow. Well, if you're using a 20-year-old protocol, yeah, it's slow. It's horribly chatty. That's why you don't use SMB 1.x. I was surprised to find out how many people were still on that old stuff. We want to get the industry up to the current SMB release, 2.2. Virtual fiber channel, yes. Virtual disks up to 64 terabytes. Native 4K disk support, live VHD merges, secure offloaded data transfer. Another key capability. This happens every time I have a conversation with folks that come to our executive briefing center. The CXOs will be sitting there, and they're all kind of tell me the same thing in a different way. But it basically boils down to this. Jeff, we like the cloud. We like this whole idea of extreme standardization. We like this whole idea of presenting and rationalizing our storage, our compute, our networking, multi-tenants. We love all this. But there's one thing that keeps us up at night. I have good processes in place, but what other safeguards can I use to protect my data? And I'll give you two examples of what keeps them up nights. Number one, this is a real case. Server hard disks appear for sale on eBay. This is a US power company. This is a very good company. These are good people. They do the right thing. They have good processes in place. Unfortunately, disks that were in their servers ended up being sold on eBay. What happened was, they actually, when they get their new servers, their old ones are given to a third party. That third party degausses them or destroys the disks. Generally, they degauss them and sell them up on eBay and recycle them, but do it in a secure way. Unfortunately, what happened here was a simple whoops moment. These disks, for some reason, didn't make it through the process. So they ended up being sold on eBay, and it contained proprietary information. Emails, customers' information, billing information, address information, all the things you don't want. And CXOs, this is the thing that keeps them up at night. Now, every so often, I'll talk to someone, and they'll say, oh, come on, Jeff. Yeah, that's the one in a million thing. We secure our infrastructure. In fact, we've got our data centers locked up tight. Okay, I believe you. Let me show you what happened just a couple weeks ago. This is a HIPAA breach. All of a sudden everyone kind of tightened up when I said HIPAA. Stolen hard drives. A large medical provider in Tennessee is paying $1.5 million to the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. What happened here? Theft of 57 hard drives that contained protected health information for over 1 million individuals. Now you're all thinking, oh, he left it. Somebody left these drives in the back of their station wagon, right? These weren't protected. Actually, these were extremely protected. They were secured by security patrols going around the building. Biometric scanner to get into the building. Secured by a key card scanner to get further into the building. Magnetic locks, and then keyed locks. The disks were still stolen, and even though they had all those in place, the Department of Health said, sorry, you're still liable. We want to solve this type of problem. This is a very, very big problem. To that end, we are providing a critical safeguard for the cloud. BitLocker encryption for cluster volumes. First time ever. With BitLocker, had they used it in either of those cases, they would have been safe. Because the only thing you can do when you get the disk is you type in the PIN or you format the disk. When our military goes into combat and they've got jump racks with servers, they're all BitLockered. Standard operating procedure, if they have to make a quick retreat, is to take a grenade, put it on the server, and run that way. The grenade takes out the server, great. If the grenade doesn't take out the server, it still doesn't matter because the bad guys can pull out the disk, plug it into the machines, and the only thing they can do is type in the PIN or format the disk. We want to bring this to everyone. And the big change here is we've supported this in the past on Server 2008 R2, but that was only with locally attached storage. Now we're doing it with cluster volumes. So now when you go deliver and create that private cloud, this is a no-brainer, folks. This should be on. This integrates with Active Directory. It integrates with group policy. And the next logical question I always get asked about this is, yeah, but what's the performance impact? The performance impact, we actually had to put in special instrumentation to find. because this is all done at the hardware level. It's actually at 0.0001. Okay, so it's essentially free, folks, because it's all done using hardware-based encryption. Critical safeguard for the cloud. All right, let's get to networking. So when it comes to cloud and hybrid clouds, there's a couple different ways you think about it that you've told us about. Number one, we need to be able to host multi-tenant workloads. You want security, you want isolation. You expect nothing less. So I talked about this yesterday, network virtualization. And here's a great, easy way to think about it. I've got two customers that I want to host in my data center. I'm a service provider. I want to bring Woodgrove Bank, I want to bring Concoso Bank into my service provider. We all agreed on terms, and they say, oh, by the way, I'm using 10.1.0.0, and I'm using 10.1.0.0. And I say, great, but I'm the hosting provider, and I'm already using 10.1.0.0. So before I host you on my infrastructure, I need you to all re-IP your workloads. How fun is that? I've talked to many customers and said, look, I've got this server here. This server's been around longer than pretty much most people in the company. We don't know what it's called. We just know this is the IP address. And we know that there are servers all throughout the company that every week or every quarter run reports on this IP address. We are not changing that IP address. There's nothing you're going to do that's going to change that. So what we want to do is we want to decouple the application from the IP address. Essentially, you both want the same thing. As a tenant, you want to easily move VMs to and from the cloud. As the hoster and the service provider, you want to place VMs anywhere in the data center. This was an interesting tidbit we got from service providers. Is today they've been using VLANs, and VLANs have lots of limitations of their own. According to the spec, there should be 4,095 VLANs. But in many cases, some switches, for example, don't do that. They top out at 128 or 255 or something, not 4,095, because who thought they were ever going to need 4,095 VLANs when they designed this, their switches ages ago? So what ends up happening is you got these big service providers that actually physically divide their servers up on VLANs, and actually workloads get caught and locked in a specific part of the data center. So service providers want the ability to be able to move VMs around their infrastructure as well. And at the end of the day, you both want easy onboarding, flexibility, and isolation. Because if I'm the service provider or if I'm the customer, we both want the same thing. I want to be able to bring my workload to the cloud with minimal disruption, without having to change IP addresses, and it just works. So with network virtualization, one way to think about it is this. I've had a lot of people struggling to understand network virtualization. And the analogy I like to use is, well, think about how we do virtual machines today. With a virtual machine, we present a virtual motherboard, processors, network, storage, and then an operating system looks at it and just installs. Whether it's, you know, Windows from 10 years ago or Linux from 10 years ago, it just looks at the hardware and says, oh, I see that, and installs on it. And it looks like it's running on physical, but it's actually on virtual, because we've presented those components and we've isolated them. We want to take those same tenets to networking. We're essentially, with network virtualization, we're running multiple virtual networks that are isolated on the same physical fabric. So here we got Woodgrove and Contoso that actually brought their IP addresses onto the same fabric. They still have their same IP addresses, yet they can't see each other. This is what I showed in the keynote yesterday, where I literally had two different companies using the same exact IP address on the same physical fabric, yet they're completely isolated. And each virtual network has the illusion that it's running and it owns the entire physical fabric. So I clearly touched a nerve yesterday in the keynote because we had so many people coming by the booth to talk about it. So I brought some data sheets for anybody who wants to know more about it, and I'll pass those out afterwards. But there's a couple of key points, and we have a ton of information online. Here are the key points you need to remember for network virtualization. Number one, multiple organizations can have their own isolated networks running atop the same physical fabric. Same switches, same NICs, same routers, same cables, but they're completely isolated. Number two, the VM is totally unaware that its IP address is being virtualized. I should also point out, doesn't matter what's running in the VM as well. It can be Windows, can be Linux, doesn't matter. I've had a bunch of people say, this is a Windows only thing, right? No. No, it's not. VMs can now run and live migrate anywhere in the data center, even across subnets.
Ooh.
That's been a big challenge, because the whole nature of subnets means if you have to traverse subnets, it means disruption to the network. This is how you solve that problem. Administrators don't need to worry about being VMs being trapped in one part of a data center because it's tied to a physical address, because we can now span and create these large virtualized networks. And finally, no other virtualization platform includes this capability, even the ones that cost a lot more. This is simply included in the box, part of Server 2012. Then from a management standpoint, it's managed via System Center. So I want to be very clear. There are two parts to network virtualization. The core network virtualization itself lives in Server 2012. It lives in the platform. But the management is handled at System Center. It wouldn't make sense to put management at the box layer because you really want to look at the entire data center. And that's where System Center comes into play. Your feedback. Wow, Windows Server 2012 network virtualization looks awesome. Where can I learn more? Well, we actually have a really nice blog that explains it in depth, and I'll have some data sheets. If you want to come by after the talk, I'll pass those out as well. But there's a search. Do a search for Windows Server 8 Hyper-V Network Virtualization, and you can find it. Nice in-depth blog that explains how we do it. There's actually two methods that we do. We have an IP rewrite mode and GRE encapsulation, two different ways. Lots more. That's an hour or two talk in and of itself. So getting back to networking now, reliability. One of the things you want to make sure is that even when the hardware fails, guess what? Customers want continuous availability. In case you haven't heard, NIC teaming is in the box. I'm so excited about this feature. Windows Server NIC teaming is now in the box. And generally, here's the thing to remember. A lot of times you buy a server, maybe it's got, you know, vendor A is on the motherboard, and then you buy another NIC and it's vendor B, and you can't team cross vendors, or if you can, but it's not technically supported. No longer in Server 2012. I was actually talking with one of the program managers in networking. He's got a server with 12 different NICs from 12 different vendors, all teamed, and it all just works. Okay? If you have a question, you call us. Just works. No more of this. Oh, it's their fault. No, just call us. NIC teaming in the box. Predictability. So you've got multiple VMs, you've got multiple workloads competing for bandwidth. You need a solution for that. You need to be able to manage to a service level agreement, and customers want predictability. If I'm a service provider and I provide you bronze or silver or platinum level support, you expect that you're going to get that. Even in an enterprise, you want to be able to provide quality of service on your networking for different types of workloads. For example, if I've got my mission critical SQL, I want to make sure that thing is never starved for network resources. On the other hand, those guys in the graphics department, every Friday, they like to fire up the plotter and print out big old huge posters, and I don't want them saturating the network either. So I can provide quality of service on a very granular level per virtual network adapter. I'll show you that in a minute. And cloud admins want scalability, and customers want performance. And finally, this is a big one, extensibility. Customers want specialized functionality with lots of choice. For firewalls, for monitoring, for fabric integration. This is a very, very big one. And let me explain why. Anybody here use VMware? Anybody? Anybody? Anybody use the Cisco Nexus 1000? Ooh, not too many. Okay. A couple things to understand about how VMware does networking, and we looked at it very carefully. They basically have what we call a closed replaceable switch. So with VMware, I can use their switch, or I can replace it with the Cisco Nexus 1000. Those are my two options. I get one or the other. We had long debates about this. We could very easily done the same thing and said, look, we'll do a closed replaceable one. But we said, you know what? That's not the way to go. We want to go with an open extensible switch. And here's what I mean by that. Here's the network stack for the Hyper-V extensible switch. Number one, let's say I just want to inspect traffic and I want to generate a report or just watch traffic as it goes across the virtual switch. SFlow by Inmon has already been announced to do exactly that. It's very lightweight. It's just to watch packets as it traverses the switch. Or what if you want to do something more in-depth than that? So for example, you'd like to actually drop packets, modify packets, insert packets. This is something that a virtual firewall wants to do. And that's exactly what the guys at Five9 have announced. And you can expect others are on the way as well. With the Windows filtering platform, gives them a lot of granularity in terms of what you want to do in terms of introspection on packets going across the switch. In addition, we've also got filtering extensions. So for example, Broadcom's working on a denial of service prevention extension. And then finally, we've got forwarding extensions. So here's where the Cisco Nexus 1000 is. But in addition, if you in Asia Pacific or in European markets, OpenFlow is actually very popular, especially in Asia Pacific. NEC has already announced an OpenFlow switch extension. So number one, you're seeing choice. If you want the Cisco Nexus 1000, awesome. It's going to be awesome, and it's right there. But if you want the OpenFlow switch, or if you want a virtual firewall for Five9, you've got some different choices there. In addition, you have flexibility. With VMware, it's this or this. With the Hyper-V switch, you can mix and match. Maybe I like the Broadcom denial of service with the Cisco Nexus 1000. Or I like the Five9 with the NEC. I can mix and match based on my business needs. In addition, in a data center, I may have one set of network requirements, like using the Cisco Nexus 1000. But in a branch office, I have a different set of requirements, where I just want to run a virtual firewall. So again, we've given you flexibility, and we've given you choice. In addition, what if you say, you know what, Jeff, this looks really cool, but you know what, I have some wacky networking need that nobody cares about. Something that only I care about in my infrastructure. I want to look for a very specific packet sequence that nobody else is going to care about. Write your own extension. Yeah, you can write your own extension. And get this, this is on the client Hyper-V as well. So now your developers can write extensions on Windows 8 for client and deploy those on server. This is about having a great solution for developers and IT pros that you can actually run in production and just move that on over to server. Feature-rich networking in the box. We've got an open, extensible virtual switch. Nexus 1000, OpenFlow, network introspection, much, much more. Advanced networking, ACLs, PVLANs, NIC teaming, it's all there. SRIOV, I'll get to that in just a second. Network QoS, and network metering. Network metering is really important, for example, for service providers. There's a couple of features that I can point at very specifically in Windows Server 2012 that we did for service providers. Resource metering is a big one. Storage metering, memory, networking, you name it. All the counters you need to do chargeback are there. A lot of enterprises tend to say, oh yeah, we want to do chargeback. They all talk about it, but generally a lot of them don't do it. Service providers, on the other hand, that's part of their business. They need these counters. It's all in there. So let's talk about SRIOV for a second. Single root I/O virtualization. So the goal of single root I/O virtualization is I'm going to go back to those scale-up workloads I mentioned before. So you've got that big honkin' SQL server that's sitting on dozens of cores, hundreds of gigabytes of memory. From a networking standpoint, it probably has 210 gig NICs in there, probably team for LBFO, and you're giving this thing as big pipes as possible. And you need this for high throughput, low latency applications. Well, we want to make sure that we can give you that capability in the VM as well. And one way to do it is SRIOV. With SRIOV, the network for the virtual machine no longer goes through the virtual switch. The VM is actually talking to a virtual function in the physical NIC and going right to the physical NIC. So it never goes to the switch, and this is fantastic for those applications that need 8, 9, 10 plus gigabit throughput in a VM. It's great for high throughput, low latency. And the nice thing about this is, we did this without compromising live migration. This is a huge, huge technical hurdle, but we are going to be the only ones. I'm sure the other guys are working on as fast as they can, but live migration with SRIOV, it's there. So the way it works is today, you've got a virtual machine that talks to a virtual NIC, That virtual NIC communicates over to VM bus to the parent or root partition, which then goes to the Hyper-V switch and down to the physical NIC. With SRIOV, it changes. With SRIOV, there's a virtual function on the hardware NIC itself. That virtual function is mapped into the VM. So there's actually two parts to an SRIOV NIC. There's the physical plane, the control plane, and there's the data plane. And the data plane is what's actually communicating the VM to the NIC. The control plane is actually the management. That's how you assigned the SRIOV NIC to the virtual machine. So now that the virtual function is in the virtual machine, the VM is communicating directly to the NIC. And again, you can see it doesn't go through the virtual switch anymore. VM mobility. So as I mentioned before, what you told us was you wanted to make sure that not only did we not reduce functionality, but to really take the safeties off. We really want to be able to live migrate everywhere. Today, we've got this. With Server 2008 R2, we've got live migration with high availability. What that means is you set up a cluster, you put your you enable Hyper-V in a cluster, and now you can live migrate VMs from server to server without downtime. If you yank out the power cable, those VMs will automatically restart on another cluster node without any user intervention. That's today. In Server 2012, we're introducing support for live migration on SMB. And the reason why I call this out and I didn't just put it under live migration with HA is because this one's a little bit different. Because SMB, if you stick it up on a file share, it's on shared storage. So you actually don't need clustering. Clustering is now optional in this configuration. So for example, suppose you're in a test dev environment, a QA environment, or even a production environment, and you don't need HA. You've got a scale-out application, you don't need HA. Or you're in a test dev environment, you don't care about it, but you still want to be able to live migrate the VM around. No problem. Set up a file server, put your VMs on it, go to town. No SAN needed, no clustering needed. If you decide later, you know what? I do want some HA. I actually do want high availability. Great. Enable clustering, and now you've got HA support. So optional there. Live storage migration. With live storage migration, now the virtual machine sits still, but the storage moves. So I can move it from direct attached storage to direct attached storage or direct to a file server or to a SAN, but it gives you flexibility in storage. And in fact, I like to always say, wouldn't it be great if you could live migrate a VM with nothing but an Ethernet cable? You may have saw me do this in the keynote yesterday. I did it with VMM. Let me show it to you using just the inbox UI. So I'm going to switch on over here. Everybody can see this? Great. So I'm running, this is the Windows Server 2012 beta. This is what's publicly available. Before I get to live migration, let me show you a couple of things. Number one, let me go back to the SAN comment I made earlier. Server 2012 includes the new virtual SAN manager. In this case, I've created a Contoso Fiber Channel SAN. So I've got a Fiber Channel HBA. You can see the worldwide node names, the worldwide port names. Okay. So there's a physical HBA in the machine. It's attached to my SAN fabric. Now, when I go to a VM, let's just go to Test VM, right-click and go to Settings, you'll see we have new hardware. We have a new fiber channel adapter. I click on Add, and lo and behold, I attach it to my SAN. Click Apply. And if I want, I can go in, set my worldwide node names, so set my worldwide port names, just like you would on a physical machine. No special magic here, just like that. From within the virtual machine, and in fact, I'm doing this specifically on Server 2008 R2, so you can see again, this is supported on down-level clients as well. Look in Device Manager. Lo and behold, it sees a Microsoft Hyper-V Fiber Channel HBA. So your application, see this is nothing different, nothing crazy, it's a Fiber Channel HBA. In addition, I demonstrated this earlier, but yes, support for 64 terabytes per virtual disk. So I've had a number of people ask me, well, Jeff, hold on here. Would I really want to create 64 terabyte disks? I mean, what about check disk? Well, then you haven't heard about Server 2012, because the chances that you're going to run into check disk are almost infinitesimal now. Check disk, you're not going to see it anymore. It's been exceptionally optimized. With check disk in Server 2012, if there's an issue, it's actually only going to run on the part of the data that was affected. We've got a whole bunch of information about this online, but all of a sudden the ability to create larger and larger LUNs makes a lot more sense if you're using Server 2012 as your guest OS. So let's go back to the VM settings for just a second. I'll show you some of the network settings. So, whole bunch of new capabilities here in the network. So we've always had VLANs. I can go in here, I can enable VLANs for a virtual machine, for a virtual NIC. But check out the bandwidth management. So again, suppose I've got SQL Server, my mission critical workload. I want to make sure that SQL Server is never, ever starved for network resources. I want to apply a quality of service. So at a minimum, I'm going to say, you know what? SQL always gets half a gigabit NIC. It always gets 512 megabits. I want to make sure that I am not going to starve SQL. On the other hand, those crazy guys off in graphics, I want to make sure when they go print their posters to the plotter, great, I can limit them to 100 megabits. If I'm a service provider providing platinum, gold, silver, type in your numbers right here, and we make sure that you provide that quality of service to a service level of agreement. In addition, let's take a look at some of the hardware acceleration changes we've made. You'll notice there's a whole bunch of new flyouts here in the network adapter that we never had before. So under hardware acceleration, we've got virtual machine queues. Virtual machine queues we actually had in Windows Server 2008 R2, but they were static virtual machine queues. You actually had to go and make some configuration, and it was all done kind of under the covers. In Server 2012, it's all dynamic, and it's all automatic. In fact, by default, this checkbox is checked. All you need to know is when you buy a NIC and it's got VMQ, which you'll want, we'll just automatically take advantage of it to improve your performance. You'll notice below it, we've got IPsec task offload. This is another key critical cloud enhancement. What we're seeing is more and more people want to do encryption on the wire. IPsec means I get it for free. It's end-to-end encryption. I don't need to do anything special in the application, and it gives me end-to-end encryption. We can do IPsec today with Windows Server 2008 R2 Hyper-V, but it means we need to do the encryption and decryption within the VM. And it's not a lot of CPU load, but if you've got 10, 12, 20, 50 VMs, that adds up quickly. So you want to actually try and reduce that if you can. With IPsec task offload, if your NIC supports this, the network adapter actually does the encryption and decryption for you. So there's no CPU load. And again, it's on by default. If your NIC supports it, great. If your NIC doesn't support it, it won't. It'll do it in software just like it always has. Here's SRIOV. So I mentioned SRIOV before. This is the capability that allows this virtual NIC to talk directly to the virtual function on the network adapter, bypasses the switch. One question I get asked is, when should I use SRIOV? Should I just be using this for everything? It sounds pretty cool. Well, not really. Here's how I think about it. SRIOV is really great for those scale-up workloads. I'm talking 8, 9, 10 plus gigabit throughput you need. Okay? If you're doing your standard file server, your standard print server, your standard web server, VMQ will easily get you up to 8 to 9 gigabits using that acceleration. When you get to SRIOV, yeah, it gives you 8, 9, 10 plus. And when we get to 40 gigabit and higher, SRIOV is going to even look more attractive. But there's one big thing you have to take into account. With SRIOV, you're talking directly to the virtual function and directly to the NIC. You are bypassing the switch. So if you're using some of the extensibility capabilities in the virtual switch, like the Cisco Nexus 1000 or any of the QoS capabilities, we can't enforce them because you've made the choice to not use the switch and go directly to the NIC. So it's not a good or a bad, it's just something to understand, because honestly, there are plenty of workloads where SRIOV makes sense, and plenty of workloads where VMQ makes sense. And then finally, let's get to advanced features. You'll notice, by the way, we're quite serious about the switch here. We wanted to make sure that we provided you a feature-rich switch. We didn't just say, hey, you know what, we've enabled extensibility, and we're going to just send you to partners for everything. We actually threw a tremendous amount of capabilities in the function, in the switch itself, because we wanted to make sure it was feature-rich. For example, DHCP guard and router guard. Okay, one thing I always like to remind people is the bad guys have credit cards too. So you're a service provider and you want to set up a hosting provider business. And the bad guys, well, they want to rent a VM. VMs are cheap, a few cents an hour, right? Great. you provision me a VM, but they put their own OS and pretend to be a DHCP server or pretend to be a router. And they want to check out what's going on in terms of network traffic. We want to help you protect against those types of attacks. Check on this, check on this, and guess what? We'll help you protect against rogue DHCP servers and rogue routers in your infrastructure. Also, port mirroring. Very commonly, we're asked about promiscuous mode, which technically isn't the right way. What you're really asking is port mirroring. You want to actually be able to look at all of the traffic coming off a specific port. You got it. You set the destination, you set the source, go for it. You can do that. I should also point out that everything I'm showing you here, this is all the inbox UI for Windows Server 2012, but more importantly, everything here can be automated via PowerShell. So automation is simply part of the package. So those are just a few of the things that we've done in terms of the networking standpoint. So let me get on over to migration for a second. So yesterday I showed you migration from Virtual Machine Manager, but let me also show you migration from within the inbox UI. So I literally have two machines here. Switch, network cable, that's it. It's the little Netgear white switch everybody probably has in their office somewhere. So nothing special, and it's literally two laptops. I'm going to move the virtual machine from demo 1 to demo 2. I'm given a couple of options here. Do I want to move the entire VM to a single location? Do I want to actually select each location? What's cool about this is, suppose I had a VM that had four different disks, and I wanted to live migrate that VM and live migrate all of the disks to four different locations. One of them, the OS disk, that can go to my file server. But the next three are my important data disks. Let's send those to a SAN. You can do all that in one fell swoop here. Nobody gives you that level of granularity except for us. Finally, I'm going to move the virtual machine. Oops, sorry, I want to move the entire virtual machine. This is Share Nothing Live Migration. It asks me, where do I want to move it? I'm going to just stick it in this folder and click Next and click Finish. So how does all this work? Everyone wants to know. Let me explain it to you. Share Nothing Live Migration number one is an incredibly difficult engineering problem to solve. Okay? We are actually doing a number of techniques to make all this work. So I've got the source that it's running on, and I want to live migrate it to the target. Again, there's no shared storage. There's no clustering, there's no SMB, there's no SAN. Literally everything is moving over the network. So the way this works is, first of all, we look at all of the on-disk representation for the virtual machine. We look at the VHDs, we look at the config files, we look at snapshots, we look at diff disks, we look at the entire virtual machine. We start to copy those over. If your underlying storage happens to have ODX, we'll take advantage of it. If not, we'll do the copy. We copy all the storage over. We also put the VM into an I/O mirroring mode. We want to make sure that writes are happening to both locations because we've got to keep the storage in sync. Then, once we've done that, then we start to move the VM, its running state, its running processes, and memory. The way we do that, first of all, suppose it's been allocated 2 gigabytes of memory. That makes make it even more difficult, 8 gigabytes of memory. Okay? Of that 8 gigabytes of memory, maybe only 50 megabytes of it is actually active. So what we do is we start copying all of the pages that are unused or aren't active first. We also track those. We'll call dirty pages. If anything changes, we have to make sure that those get across as well. What we finally do is we get that working set as small as possible. Once we get it down to that last 50 megabytes or whatever that number is, then we do a very quick brownout and we bring it up on the other server. Once we're able to do that and we can begin execution on the target, then we've completed the Share Nothing Live Migration. We delete everything on the source, and we continue running on the other side. Now, I've just taken an extremely difficult engineering problem and solved it, then explained it in like a minute, but that's how it works, okay? And then, by the way, in the middle, I should also point out that live migration itself has been greatly enhanced from Server 2008 R2 as well, because for us to support concurrent live migrations, we've had to make changes to the algorithm itself. It's been very efficiently optimized. One question I've been asked is, the guys over at VMware have this thing they've given some special name, stunned, pages, I don't know, some wacky name I don't remember off the top of my head. Basically, it works like this, is I mentioned dirty pages being copied over. As the VM is actually copying those dirty pages over, there is a pathological case where if the VM is actually changing dirty pages very, very fast, you can get in a case where the live migration will never catch up. Okay? So to solve that problem, one of the things you can do is you can change and adjust the performance of the virtual machine so that you can ensure you're always making forward progress. And that way you can ensure that your live migration always continues and it always, always happens. And I've been asked by a number of people, hey, they've got this stun thing in vSphere 5. What do you have? Well, turns out we've had this in Server 2008 R2. We do this already today. We just didn't give it a fancy name. We just assumed you got to have this to have a true live migration solution. So it's already in there. It's already in the box. We just didn't give it a fancy name. But that's how Share Nothing Live Migration works. And there's some of the key changes that we've made to live migration to make it just an integral part of Windows Server 2012. And like that, I have moved a VM from one server to another without any sort of downtime. All over my little old 1 gigabit Netgear switch running here on stage. Just for giggles, I'm in building 43 at Microsoft. I'm on the first floor. I have a couple machines in my office. I live migrated a VM from my office on the first floor to the lab on the fourth floor, down to the lab on the second floor. Then I migrated it over to building 42. Then I migrated over to building 41. Then I migrated over to building 25. And I forgot to actually check in distance how many miles we went. But then eventually I live migrated back to my office. None of this was shared storage. And once you realize the mobility and flexibility this brings you, the scenarios are mind-blowing. Okay? I spoke with two of the largest oil companies in the world in the last 6 months. And they saw this feature and they said, done deal. And I said, hold it, you guys have plenty of shared storage. Why do you care about this feature? And they said, no, here's the deal. Our data centers, we got SANs everywhere. That's not a problem. The problem is in our oil rigs, okay? We've got these branch offices that are literally oil rigs. We've got hundreds of these that are in the middle of the ocean, and we got anywhere from 10 to 20 servers on these oil rigs. These guys said, we can't afford to put a SAN on every one of these oil rigs. Now, first of all, that's weird coming from an oil company because generally they have more money than anybody else. So when those guys say, we can't afford to put a SAN in every one of these locations, but they said, this is exactly what we need. Because we need to be able to service the underlying hardware, add storage, add memory, make changes to the host partition, do whatever, all of those things without any downtime, using only the network. So huge capabilities. The other reason for Shared Nothing Live Migration is clusters. As I mentioned yesterday in the keynote, there is no way today to live migrate a VM between separate clusters on any platform. Can't do it, because you always need shared storage. Ah, but now you can. You can live migrate between clusters because you don't need that shared storage anymore. The other thing is, if you're a large enterprise or service provider, if you just got a large number of servers, if you want to live migrate a VM from server 1 to server 500, you're not going to create a 500-node cluster, folks. Okay? Well, now you can. You can live migrate from server 1 to server 500 because you're not limited by cluster nodes or cluster scale. And at the same token, we support 64 nodes and 4,000 VMs in a cluster as well. So we got you covered there as well. So those are just a few things I wanted to point out with Windows Server 2012. And I'll come back to the demo in just a minute. But quite simply, the best when it comes to VM mobility. It's all there. Live migration with HA, SMB live migration, live storage migration, and shared nothing live migration. Oh, and I do want to point out one more thing. I want to be very transparent about this. Shared Nothing Live Migration is a mobility feature. It is not high availability. Be very clear with everybody. If I walk up to that server and yank out the power cable, VM isn't going anywhere because I didn't configure clustering. Okay? If you want that, do live migration with HA or do SMB live migration. However, when you need to move that VM around, you don't have the shared storage, you don't need the shared storage, you don't have the budget for the shared storage, we don't want you to be limited by that either. So we've got all of the solutions in the box for you. And every new feature in Hyper-V works with live migration, without exception. That was your requirement. We made sure it's in there. DR. Wow. So this has been a very interesting road. I've been talking to a lot of folks that are interested in virtualization and DR, and how can they use virtualization to really enhance their DR solutions and strategies in their environments. So this, to me, has been kind of seared in my mind. This is Hurricane Katrina. This is August 28th, 2005. What you're seeing here are 175-mile-an-hour sustained winds with gusts of over 200 miles an hour. This is the worst natural disaster in U.S. history. $110 billion in damage. Over 1,000 people lost their lives. Over 80,000 businesses were destroyed or heavily impacted. To this day, there are people still rebuilding their lives, rebuilding their businesses from this disaster. And there's a number of things that have bothered me since this disaster. Here's the biggest one. We knew this was coming for a week. I grew up in California. We have earthquakes. There's no warning. They just happen. However, if someone said, by the way, your house is going to burn down in a week, what would you do? We knew this was coming, folks. DR technology has literally been around for decades. Why did so many people lose everything? Even with a full week's notice. DR technology is not new. Well, there's a number of challenges with it. Number one, cost. DR today, I'm going to paint with a very broad brush for just a moment. DR generally means I buy SAN 1 here, and I buy the identical SAN over here, and I set up replication between the two. Okay? It's generally what it means. Not the most inexpensive thing in the world. And it's going to be the same SAN. Number two, complexity. Let's just look at one tiny aspect of DR, the network. I've got one site running here with one IP address range on one subnet, and I need it to fail over to another IP address range on another subnet. Oh my gosh, how do I deal with that? Number three, inflexibility. This goes back to storage. Today, generally, DR means you buy the SAN and you buy the same exact SAN here. Well, what if you've got a branch office that doesn't have a SAN? I've got a branch office that has direct attached storage or a file server, and I'd like to replicate that back to my data center that's got a SAN. Or I've got two branch offices, one's in Sacramento and one's in San Francisco. My main office is actually in Omaha, Nebraska, but what if I could do DR to those same locations that are relatively close to each other? Number four, initial replication. This is a big one. If that first replication is 40 gigabytes, that could take me hours, days, or even weeks, depending on the size of my pipes. And then finally, distance requirements. Generally, synchronous replication means 150 kilometers, give or take. But what if I want to go longer than that? I want to go Seattle to Dallas, Seattle to Chicago, Seattle to Hyderabad. Well, synchronous isn't the way to go. You need an async solution. So we've looked at this and we said, we want to provide a solution to help you protect your data. If you're a service provider, help protect your customers' data. That's Hyper-V Replica. Hyper-V Replica is asynchronous, application-consistent VM replication built into Windows Server 2012. Number one, it works with all of your storage. You want to do direct attached storage to direct attached storage, it just works. You want to do direct attached storage to a file server to a SAN, you can mix and match. If I can see and I can write to my storage, I can replicate to my storage. In terms of the network pipes, this is a question I'm asked all the time. Do I need some big synchronous pipes? No, no, no. Our goal was to go after commercially available broadband. I got guys on my team that are actually replicating between their homes over cable modems. Got a lot of smiles there. I was in Brazil, and in Brazil, their issue is floods. They have these on a regular basis. It's gotten so bad that the federal government has said all new IT spend over a specific dollar amount has to have a DR solution. I spoke with their architects, and they said, quite simply, we don't know what to do here because we can't afford all the SANs that we're going to need. I showed them this, and they said, oh my gosh, done deal. I can have replica in Sao Paulo, I can have replica in Brasilia, and I can go between cities. Because the network pipes aren't the problem, it's the storage, at least for them. In addition, This is integrated with the hypervisor itself, because Hyper-V knows the state of the workload. It knows the state of the processors, the memory, the storage, the network, to make sure we're doing the right thing. So let me switch on over back to Replica for just a minute here. I know I'm running short on time here, so let me go to this quickly. So let me just pick a random VM, Windows Server 8 Beta. Let's enable replication. And again, everything I'm showing you here is in the box. Everything I'm showing you here can be automated via PowerShell. So I'm going to click on Enable Replication. It says, where do you want to replicate this to? All right, number one, Kerberos or certificate-based. If I own both sides of the pipe, for example, I'm on a domain, maybe I'm going across campus or two locations that I own, use Kerberos. If I'm working with a service provider, I'm going to want certificate-based authentication, and that traffic will be encrypted. We've got that as well. In addition, we understand that you want to take best advantage of your network resources, so we do compression on by default. On average, we've seen we save about 40% in terms of network traffic. When you're talking about dealing with network metered traffic, that's a very important thing. That's on by default. Now I simply select the disks I want to replicate. I've got one here, so that's real simple. Now I can configure my recovery history. By default, we'll keep one recovery point. However, maybe this is so important that I want to keep multiple snapshots in time. I want to keep the last four recovery points. Well, check this out. This is something new we added in the beta. You can see here it's going to need 6.93 gigabytes of storage if I decide I need four recovery points. What if I need, I don't know, eight recovery points? Then it automatically changes to let me know how much storage I'm going to need to have those additional replication points. Or here's 10. In addition, it's VSS aware, volume shadow services. So if your guest is running something that's VSS aware, file server, SQL, something like that, we'll actually call down into the guest and say, guest, by the way, make sure you properly quiesce and flush everything to disk. Get yourself in an application consistent manner, and we're going to take the replicated snapshot. Now, it's not on by default because we don't know what your guest is going to be or what the application is going to be. Say, for example, it was Linux. What? Yeah. Doesn't matter what's running in the guest. It can be any OS. So, yeah, it supports that as well. So let's click. I'm going to go with a single recovery point. I'm going to click Next. And now we have the initial replication method. So guess what? We can do the initial copy over the network. Oh, let's suppose this is 40 gigabytes. 40 gigabytes could take some time. So instead, you know what? Let's do the initial copy using external media. I could put this on a USB stick, FedEx it to my secondary site. Got a lot of smiles after this one. FedEx it to my offsite, and guess what? Now I just replicate the diffs. So instead of 40 gigabytes, maybe it's a couple megabytes. So we thought of that one too. If you decide, no, I actually do want to do it over the network, I just don't want to do it right now. I want to do it maybe on Friday at 7 p.m. after everybody's left the building, and I have nice clear network pipes the entire weekend long, great. You can schedule it to start later in the week at a specific time. I'm going to start the replication immediately. I'm going to click Next, and I'm going to click Finish. And just like this, I'm enabling replication. Now, replication's been enabled successfully. We're not done yet. Let's click on Settings. I want to show you something. So, now that we've enabled replication, I mentioned the whole IP settings. How do I deal with the fact that I was running on site one on one set of IP addresses on one subnet, and now I got to fail over, and I've got to use new IP address settings on a new subnet, and how do I make all that work? We thought of that too. So now, if we go back to the network adapter, guess what? There's a new option here called failover TCP/IP. So guess what? When you set up replication, by the way, do you want to go ahead and type in that IP address, that subnet mask, the default gateway, your DNS server? So when that VM failover, when you have to do the actual failover, we'll inject the IP address into the VM. So when you come up on the new site, guess what? It works. A lot more smiles there as well. I'll get your question in just a minute. So that works both for IPv4 and IPv6. And by the way, I get lots of questions about DNS. You still got to handle DNS yourself, guys. You got to set that up, okay? But this allows you to change and deal with the IP addresses as you handle the failover. And I'm going to go ahead and click. Let's see. I don't need to do anything here, actually. Let's go ahead and click OK. And right now, this initial replication is still occurring. Just to be very clear, I don't want anyone going, wow, that's happening awfully fast. No, it's between two machines right here. So let me be very clear, it's over my gigabit network. I don't want anyone thinking, oh my gosh, that's been going, that's really fast. But I do have a VM here that's running, and I can view the replication health. So one of the things you're going to see as you're running replica is you want to know, how successful am I being? Am I actually able to keep up with all of the changes happening on my server? Do I need bigger pipes, or is the size of my pipes enough? Well, you need that information, and we include it. Here's the replication health for the OS. And you can see right here, I've done 63 out of 63 successful replications. Maximum size, average size, I haven't been doing much on this machine. But it gives me the information in terms of replication and what I need from a bandwidth standpoint. So I could look over time and realize, hey, I've got enough bandwidth, or maybe I need to add some more a little later time, or maybe I want to add more VMs to be replicated, so I need to budget for that accordingly. So I am already over time, but let me come back over here and finish on up here. So last thing I've got to mention, everyone's been coming by the booth asking me this question. Can you help me convert my VMware VMs to Hyper-V? So a couple things I want to announce. We just announced this last week, the new Microsoft Virtual Machine Converter Solution Accelerator in beta. So this allows you, it's a free, standalone, 4 megabyte, that's right, megabyte, download that converts VMware virtual machines to Hyper-V. It converts the entire VM. It's not just the disk. It converts the VMs, the virtual disk, the configuration. It installs the VMware tools and has an easy-to-use GUI. If you decide you'd like to automate this, it also has a command line interface as well. It supports vSphere 4.1, vSphere 5. You can see a nice-looking, easy-to-use virtual machine dialog. Literally, you point it at the vCenter server. You'll get your list of VMs, and now you can start converting to Hyper-V. And again, this will be a free tool, be supported by Microsoft. And it will convert to Server 2008 R2, both Windows Server and our free standalone Microsoft Hyper-V server. Support for Server 2012 is not in there yet, but you can bet it's coming very, very soon. And here's the download site. You guys will have access to my slides. You'll be able to download, but it's publicly available, the Microsoft Virtual Machine Converter. So finally, why Windows Server 2012 Hyper-V for private cloud? Real simple. Number one, massive scalability in a box. You want 32 virtual processors, you want a terabyte of memory, great. No memory taxes here. Zippo, nada. 64 terabytes of virtual disks, biggest in the industry. Hyper-V replica, unlimited replication. What do I mean by that? Well, the guys over at VMware do have a software replication, but here's how it works. You gotta go buy vSphere, you gotta go buy vCenter, you gotta go buy SRM, and then they charge you for every VM that you replicate. The first 75 VMs cost you $200 each. Starting with VM 76, it's $600 each because you're now a big customer. Okay, this is the exact wrong way to look at this. Okay, we want to help you protect your data. Okay? We want you to protect your data, in fact, help others protect their data. Unlimited replication, replicate as many as you want. There is no replication tax in Hyper-V. Unparalleled VM mobility, no one has shared nothing live migration, and we're including it in the box. Open extensible switch, most advanced inbox switch, integration with Cisco Nexus 1000, and if you don't like it or if you need something else, go write your own switch extension. You could do it on client. Offloaded data transfer for SAN support, and we're still the only virtualization solution with in-guest hardware GPU. Still. And the beta is available now. So with that, I am way over time. I just want to say thank you very much. I hope you have a great time here at MMS. Thank you very much. Please, we've got lots of topics here at MMS on private cloud. Please complete your session evaluation, and I'll be at the booth. If you want to talk more about Hyper-V, network virtualization, replica, Server 2012, happy to answer any more questions. Thank you very much.